Yo, what's cracking? This your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Episode number 61 of the Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. This week's podcast is sponsored by Jackson Hole Mountain Resort. We just had an amazing contest up at Jackson Hole. Kings and Queens of Corbett went down today, Tuesday. I think today's the 11th. And my special guest today, he is a legend in Jackson Hole in the ski industry, especially when it comes to ski photography. Welcome, Wade McCoy.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's good to be here.
Awesome.
It's good to be up on the hill today. Boy, that was some cold weather as usual. It usually is single digits and blowing hard. And the whole scene there is so cool with the MC and the music and the wild moves going into Corbett's. I love it.
How has the progression been in the sport that you've watched over the years?
Well, it's off the hook.
Yeah.
It progressed into the athletics of, you know, the modern day pools and are there sponge catching places and all the great modern tools that the kids are using to practice, and then take it into that natural terrain. And Corbett's is such a awe-inspiring sight when you look at it. It's just this cleave and the cliffs in all directions. And the cornice was really big this year too.
Yeah, it was massive. I mean, it's such a interesting venue. And like you said, you know, that progression of the sport, it seems a lot of these athletes are almost gymnasts now. The training that they're doing, it involves the pools, it involves the airbags. You know, some of them are, I mean, they're trying to, you know, I've noticed some of the athletes, especially in snowboarding, are shorter now. And so I think it's just an interesting progression of the sport, but to watch it go, I love seeing people go into free skiing terrain, you know, powder and unnatural. And I think that hopefully the sport, both skiing and snowboarding, is starting to possibly go away from, you know, park riding and half pipe. I mean, there's no half pipe within 6 hours of here. But it seems like this whole free ride movement, like what we saw today, it's inspiring. And I think it's more attainable to a skier or snowboarder, like, oh, one day I could do that. Maybe when you watch the half pipe and, you know, the guys just did the 2300s on the snowboard, that's a little much. And it's like, okay, that might not be attainable. But I bet you somebody, if they really wanted to, could learn, you know, maybe they don't get into Corbett's, but one day they could go jump off something and do stuff like that into fun terrain. So it was great to see.
Yeah. Yeah, very inspirational to see, you know, the men, the women, snowboarders and skiers just, you know, doing things into Corbett's that I had taken photographs of Corbett's, you know, for so long, and I saw some huge airs, but I had never seen anything like that.
Yeah, like a new bar has almost been set, you know, and your photos over the years, I mean, you had stunning pictures of Corbett's, and now it's like, well, just that level of athleticism. Yeah.
You know, when you see those older pictures of Corbett's, they're really super cool. There's one in particular, there are a lot of people standing around the rim and the clothing is 70s.
Yep.
And the jump was big and steep and kind of gnarly looking. And the skier was definitely going for it.
For sure. When did you first move to the Tetons, or when did you first come up to Jackson?
I rolled into Jackson Hole in 1974 in a Ford Econoline van driven by my college roommate, who said to me, make sure you graduate on time because we're going out to Jackson Hole and be ski bums. I knew nothing about skiing. We were in the Deep South. We were in Atlanta, Georgia. My friend had skied Europe and knew that Jackson Hole was the closest thing to Europe. And so he came and picked me up. We did graduate on time. And he came and picked me up and we drove out. And my first sight of Jackson Hole was driving over Togarty Pass. And that is quite an impressive entrance. And it's just amazing.
To see the cathedral of the Tetons as you come down the pass.
Oh, yeah. And they are revealed. And then you're in Jackson Hole and you're driving past them and they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. So that was huge.
At what point did you pick up a camera? Or when you were in Atlanta, were you a hobbyist or did this?
Yeah, I was the same roommate. His name is Tom Pippin. And he bought a book on my Kickstarter campaign.
Great.
Thank you, Tom. I went to Europe for 3 months. I had two other guys, all on motorcycles, Triumphs, and we had a fifth with a Fiat Spitfire sports car. And we toured Europe for 3 months with no plan, and got up every day and went down the road. We had a nice big map, and over those 3 months, we visited 15 countries and drove 10,000 miles. And we shipped the motorcycles back to the U.S. and had them back home for a while. And I skied in Zermatt, Switzerland for the first time in my life, summer skiing on a glacier, and had a ball, you know, fell all the way down the glacier and laughing and in my blue jeans, soaking wet, spring snow.
Did you have the big Southern accent too? I mean, were you just
different? Mississippi accent's pretty light, but yeah, I definitely had it. I lost it. I tried to keep it. One of the old time ski patrolmen says, "Hey man, it's cool you got that accent. You better keep that, you know." And I was reading all this stuff because it was like, you got all these changes in your life. One thing needs to remain constant. I was like, okay, my speech will remain constant. All these changes in my life. I moved out here and I'm learning to ski. And I couldn't keep it because I lived with two guys, one from Minnesota and one from New Jersey. And we would sit around at the end of the day and talk about our day of skiing. And if I wanted to get any words in at all, I had to speak really quickly. If I talked my normal gait with the Southern accent, and that was a terrible imitation. It was Southern accent, by the way.
It's been a while, clearly,
yeah,
since you've done it.
Right. But when I get around those guys, so I keep in touch with some of the guys I went to high school with, and they still have it.
Did you bring a camera over to Europe with you?
Or? Well, that was the question, and I did. And I documented the trip, and I also kept a diary, so I started writing. And writing was a big part of my career, too. It enabled me to do jobs that I wouldn't have been able to do just as a photographer. Back, you could sell a Powder magazine story, and they would give you some money to go on this trip if, you know, and I would be able to write and shoot. And then I would get additional money from companies that would also sponsor the trip, and we would get gear. And these trips were ski mountaineering trips to South America and some in Europe, Alaska, really all over the world. I never made it to Asia. I made it to China.
Okay.
We went ski mountaineering in China.
I love this, that you were pitching this, and especially as a creative person, we hire a lot of photographers, and hopefully one day you and I can work together. My three main photographers, Greg Von Dorsten, Connor Burksmith, and Rich Goodwin, have all written articles for me now. Yeah. And I said, look, as a photographer, that's great, but you probably can open yourself up into a bigger category if you're also able to write about this. And even with the athletes, a lot of times I pull my friends away. I'm like, what's your end plan here? Like, why don't you grab a camera?
Yes.
Start writing about this.
Yes. And that's that pissed off a lot of photographers about 10 years ago when a lot of the athletes started doing that. And digital equipment made it accessible so that everyone could do it. And it's a whole different ballgame now. And it's still it's like there's so much creativity out there and there's so much work available. It seems like there are a lot of people doing good work.
Yeah, I know. It's inspiring. I mean,
it is.
You know, that's just why I got into skiing. I mean, back in the day, watching the photos of Glenn Plake and Scott Schmidt and the long skinny skis and the fluorescent and the jump turns. I mean, that inspired me. And that was all originally through the magazines. And then when I moved here, I picked up a magazine called JH Skier, I think it was. Was that your magazine?
That was my magazine. Me and Bob Woodall put that together. It started off as the title was The Village Focus. You know, we were channeling Bob Dylan there or something, that whole Greenwich Village thing, which I don't know much about and I don't pretend to. But I love Bob Dylan, man. Holy cow. My English teacher, by the way, and if people are wondering what the public education system in the Deep South was in 1970, 68, 69, 70. I was a senior. In my junior year, my English teacher, a woman, said to us, "One day, Bob Dylan will be known as a great poet." And then he wins the Pulitzer Prize for poetry like 40 years later. And that pissed all the poets off. Yeah. But there it is. He was a great poet, and she recognized that. So, you know, it's no secret that a lot of literary and musically talented people come from the South as well as from everywhere in the country.
What are some of the challenges of being a photographer in the outdoor elements?
You have to keep yourself warm. You have to keep yourself hydrated. You have to keep yourself fed. You have to carry a lot of weight. You have to make sure you stay safe in your terrain choice, your position. You have to keep your equipment dry, and you have to dial your equipment in to the settings that you choose for the particular scene. You have to decide which lens to use, what angle. And there's so many ways to shoot it. There's 6 or 10 or 12 ways to shoot it. And you have to pick from like there are probably 3 or 4 staring you in the face, and you have to pick one. And then, so you do, that's pretty easy. You just pick one. And a lot of times, if there's more than one photographer on the scene, there's one position and setup that seems to be the most popular. And that brings up an interesting story. I didn't get to shoot much ski racing, but I did shoot some World Cup ski racing at one point in my career. And I was shooting a race in Aspen, Colorado. I was on the road for like 2 weeks following the World Cup around the Western United States. It was just such a blast. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Just on the fly, too. I mean, I had an assignment letter so I could get press credentials, and but it was really on spec.
Yeah.
And I did sell some pictures from that trip, though, and it was just such a trip. I'm at, I think it was Aspen. I can't remember. It might have been Heavenly Valley. I think it was Heavenly Valley. And so as with a press credential, you can get on course, and you can sideslip the course before the race, and you can pick your spot. And so I did that. I inspected the course, and I'm na 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 na, and I found a couple of good 3, 4, 5 spots. Okay, oh, and then I found this spot. It's like, oh, that's the spot. Yeah. So I showed up for the race. You got to get there, you know, a certain amount of time before, and then there, no, you can't move. Nobody moves. And so I got there, you know, I don't know, probably 20 minutes before I really needed to, and I got in my spot. And we're all wearing crampons because it's, you know, ice, hard as snow. And so you have crampons on and you have your camera pack and that's it. So I'm in position and there's 3 or 4 people there already. And I show up and there's 3 or 4 people, 5 people already. And I show up, I'm certainly not the first person there. And, you know, other people are showing up and gathering around. And all of a sudden, this girl shows up and she gets really close to me with her crampons and she's stomping her feet and she stabbed me in the calf with her crampon spike and it tore my clothes and I was bleeding. And she didn't say, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. She just moved me off that spot and got her gear out.
Wow, so cutthroat, the FI, that kind of ski racing is a little different, you know, in the photography world or back then, man.
Well, but, you know, to give her credit, she was the king dog at the time. She was, you know, she was on staff. She had priority. But I gave her her spot, didn't whine about getting bloodied and, you know, just got my gear out and shot over her shoulder and it all worked out fine.
So now that you're not doing the JH Skier, you had this whole collection of all your photographs from the years. I mean, what, we're talking 50, 60 years on snow? I mean, just doing the quick math.
Well, no, 45 years shooting, This is my 50th year anniversary. This is my 50th winter in Jackson Hole. 50 in a row having a ski pass at the Jackson Hole ski area and then renamed the Jackson Hole Mountain Resort.
Did you get in on one of the lifetime passes, or do you remember when they did that?
We were an employee, Bob and I. We worked for the marketing department as their content producers. And we got passes and we got a little stipend to buy film, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
You know, we got early access, and they knew that was the hook.
Yeah.
And that's always been the hook.
Yes.
And it's big resorts all over the world use the same tactics.
Yes.
And so we were hooked because Jackson Hole, oh my gosh.
So we got all these great photos, and now what are you doing with them? I mean, I brought you in here for a reason. You've got some big news. What's going on in your world right now with the photography stuff?
Well, Mike, for 4 years plus, I've been working on a coffee table book, The Arc of Skiing Jackson Hole, 45 Years Behind the Lens. And I launched my Kickstarter 6 days ago, and it funded in 6 days.
You're officially fully funded?
Fully funded as of yesterday at 5 p.m.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I think it was, 70,000? I mean, it was
80,000.
It was a good number.
Yes, and I was nervous about that, and yep. Other people were nervous about that. Maybe this isn't going to work. And I am so excited that people went, oh, well, that's really not that much money. I mean, it isn't when you consider the size of the book, 384 pages.
This is a big, heavy coffee table book. It's not a little.
No, it's a big book. It's 10 inches by 12 inches, 12 inches tall, 10 inches wide. 384 pages is a little over, it's about 1¾ inches thick, weighs 6 pounds, and has over 500 photos. And the text is a memoir, and it's 44,888 words worth of just my stories behind the photos and the lifestyles that we led.
Yeah.
Through the decades, and it's broken up into decades. It's organized in decades. Very photo heavy, you know, lots of white space to let the photos breathe, and a lot of interesting reading if you want to read about it, and you can flip through it without reading it. And, you know, every page is like, sometimes I can just stare at these photos for so long. And I've seen them so many times, and I'm flipping, making the final PDFs right now for the press. And today I was flipping through them, and I would just stop on a page, and before I knew it, a couple of minutes had gone by, and it's like, wait a minute, I got to be somewhere at 5 for this podcast.
Love it. I love it.
Sucked in, you know, it can be a number of things, the terrain that you're seeing, the athlete's position, the light, it all mixes into this thing that just grabs you.
Going from being a photographer and a writer and a content guy, were there any challenges to going to the publishing world? You know, I had Tom Turiano on, he was a great friend, and it seems like this is, you know, I'm going to write a book. And I mean, I think there's a whole different component. Like, it sounds good on paper and you have the photos and you can write about this, but it seemed, you know, even talking to Greg when he launched his book, it seems like this is something that I don't know most. I mean, people are like, Mike, you should write a book. I'm like, oh, cool, I could write it. I'm like, oh, whoa, there's this whole, okay, it's done. Now there's a whole second component to it. And it was that something that you kind of obviously had to navigate through, or did you find somebody else that was like, hey, I know how to do this and we can run with it?
No, I did the whole thing myself because I had to. I have no budget to pay. Now, I did pay two editors, and I'm paying a designer, and I've had some production cost with some press proofing and some office, a lot of ink, and computer equipment and software. But the production work I was able to do myself. And the only reason I would ever try to do this is I built a magazine for, you know, 37 years. We produced those magazines. We produced three magazines a year. the Jackson Hole skier, and then a summer edition of that we called, our first title was Mountain Country, which we should have stuck with because it's a lovely title.
Yep.
But then we thought, oh, we got to have Mountain Country. We got to be more area specific. So we were then the Teton Yellowstone Adventure Guide.
Yep.
And that was a successful magazine too, because of course the, you know, the advertising dollars, they were free distribution magazines, you know, paid solely for by what advertising we could sell. We were a very small publishing company, did a lot of the work ourselves. Of course, we had ad salespeople. But the production we did ourselves. And so I knew how to build a document and I knew how to adjust photos for the press and for printing. And those two things alone, you know, if you had to pay someone to do them, you're spending tens of thousands of dollars. Sure. I'm not sure exactly how much it would cost. I don't know. What the work I did for my book, if I had paid for it, I would hope somebody would charge me 40 grand because it sure felt like about 60 grand's worth of work. It's been 4 years for crying out loud.
Yeah. And so most of our readers and listeners, they're skiers, they're snowboarders, they're outdoor people. I mean, everybody knows of Jackson. Your photos are stunning. What is the best way to order the book, and then how can people just follow along on what you're doing? I mean, because I love that you're posting a lot of legacy photos. When I see, you know, again, the photo of the group of people in Corbett's and they're in clothes that you can tell are from a different generation of skiing, a different decade. I mean, it's just like, what? That's what you skied in? Just silly. So what's going to be the easiest way for our listeners to get the book from you? And then how can they also kind of just follow along on what Wade's doing and just all your stuff from over the years?
I'm actively posting on Instagram and Facebook. And it's the Instagram is at Wade McCoy, just all lowercase, no space, McKoy.
Okay, so everybody's on Insta, so you can follow Wade McCoy. And honestly, if you're a skier or snowboarder and you start typing in Wade and MC, it's going to pop up with the algo. And then as far as the book, people want to get this. First of all, when can they receive the book? Do you have a...
The books will be here in June. The Kickstarter campaign, where you can buy the book now or pre-order the book, will end on the 21st of February, which is two Fridays from now. And so I would encourage people to get the book now or to buy the book now, because when they get here in June, the only way to get them at that point would be through a retail outlet. I won't be selling them online, I don't believe. You would be able to buy them online from the shops that sell them and also have online businesses. And I think most of them do, but it'll cost more then. So now is the time. So the most effective way to buy the book is in a box of six that you pick up here. And I think it works out to $114 plus sales tax on that is what, another, I don't know,
10, 15 bucks or something.
I don't think it's that much. I think it's maybe $6. It's 6% of, so 114. So yeah, it's maybe $8.
Yeah.
And that's the least expensive price on the book. And the five friends, and if six people get together, and you know, it comes in one box and one person picks it up, and we'll have some pickup areas organized. And I haven't figured all that out yet. And of course, everybody wants the book to be signed. And I'm trying to figure out how, you know, that could be coordinated with a pickup, and that's kind of complicated. And I don't know if it'll work or not, but it's an option. And you know, other options are, you know, you get the book in the mail or you pick it up at the pickup spot, and then there'll be book signing events at certain times during the next month or 6 weeks and different places, different times. You'll be able to bring your book in, and that should take care of, you know, everybody that lives close by. And then the people that aren't close by, then I'm not sure how that's going to work, because, you know, in the fulfillment area, I'm not sure how that, I had a fulfillment plan all locked in, but I'm rethinking it. And I don't know where I'm going to land on this decision. It's kind of a mind bender at this point.
little different than the distribution you had with the magazine of just dropping off stacks
in
cool places.
It's a whole different animal. And
there's some options there, and I'm just trying to figure out which one is the best for the people that bought the book.
Yeah,
is what I'm trying to figure out, what is the easiest for all of those supporters. The reason that the book exists is because of the people who threw down. And I was just so excited and amazed at the response. Anecdotally, I'd been told, yes, this is going to happen. And I wanted to believe it. That was the business plan. And I had all these things in place to make it happen. And by golly, it happened. And it blew me away when it happened. I was like, wow. I mean, you know, you start to see the numbers go up. You know, it's like in the first hour, we're at 6-8 grand. And then in the first day, I think we was at 30 grand. In the first day, like, oh, this is happening. And then you just keep, you know, pushing it and pushing it. And then, you know, by day 6, we're at 80 grand.
Well, and with still days to go. I mean, this,
we have 10
this
days
number
to go.
Is going to grow.
Yes. It needs to grow, because at 80 grand, I'm still not making any money. I'm just, you know, I'm ecstatic that we'll have a book in print, but yeah, it'd be nice to make some money too. And, you know, otherwise, you know, selling them at wholesale isn't nearly as attractive as what the Kickstarter, even though Kickstarter takes a cut, I'll still come out way ahead if people would buy them now rather than later.
And I think people love supporting, you know, you as a person directly, you know, even if Kickstarter's getting their cut versus, oh, I can buy it, you know, on Amazon or somewhere else.
Well, no, you can't buy it on Amazon.
Right. Or
the only place would be the bookstores.
Yep.
And only in Jackson Hole and Victor and Driggs.
I love it.
So that, you know, it's going to be, but, you know, I mean, you can buy them online through those bookstores. I don't want to sell them online because that is a full-time job. And I've still got a bunch of stuff to do with this book. With, you know, hopefully, you know, the ultimate plan is put together a slideshow, you know, and have events locally. I do not want to take this on the road.
I bet our local community would love that, because, like, to be able to go and hang with you and get it signed, and like it's a night with Wade, kind of like Jimmy's doing his thing out at the Teton Mountain Lodge. Just like, hey, come out and let's have dinner. Let's look at stuff. Let's, you know, we got books.
Yeah, well, you know, I kind of envision it at the Center for the Arts, big slideshow, which has to be produced. Yep. You know, it's not just, you know, and I would want help with that.
Yep.
I've done everything myself so far except the design. I had a lot of help with design. I had great editors. So that's all really solid. But I don't think I want to try to do, because a slideshow can be so powerful if done right. And, you know, I just see it as something that someone that has experience doing that. I have experience doing that, and I could put it together, but I just don't have it in me to do it right now.
Well, and the fact you said Center for the Arts, like you'd want to come in home run swinging.
I mean, exactly.
Just fully pro, because everyone knows your photography. It's like,
it has to be wow.
Yes.
And so someone has the ability to do that. Someone that lives here, someone that would do it on almost like a partnership thing,
100%.
Where you would say, okay, look, we'll just split the gate, or, you know, you can have certain rights to this, whatever it takes.
I mean, the book sounds like an incredible bang for the buck. I mean, over 500 photos with 30,000-40,000 words.
Yes.
I mean, this is, you're not going to sit through this in one sitting. I mean, this is something you're going to have for your life, and it's going to take you, I mean, even if you're like, okay, every day I'm going to get into it. I mean, this is insane. I love it.
Well, you can rip through it in, you know, a half hour, or you can spend 2 days looking at it. I bet if you sat down and really read it, it would, when I was proofreading it, it would take me 10 hours to get through it. But that's long, because I would be stopping and maybe even doing a little rewriting while you're proofreading. So I think you could probably do it in 8 hours if you were a good speed reader. But then you can't, because some of this stuff is kind of heavy. And you just have to stop and think about it for a minute. It's like, wait a minute, what? What did he just say? I mean, most of it is not heavy, but there is some pretty heavy stuff in there.
I was going to ask you about avalanches and avalanche education. Are you just, because you mentioned, you know, terrain and not being in the wrong terrain, you know, is one of the things for photographers, even for athletes. Have you taken formal avalanche education, or did you just go out with people that were really, you know, mentors, and you guys all kind of self-taught each other?
Well, yeah, all of the above. I photographed a lot of ADDIE classes. And so I was really a student too. I was paying attention to what they were saying, and I would sit through these things. So I did have that going for me, and as well as the mentors. I mean, I'm hanging out with the ski patrol. I'm going out on snow control with them. I'm hanging out with the guides. So the osmosis, you know, I mean, listening, I'm a listener. I'm listening to everything they say and trying to assimilate it and trying to. And then, you know, I got slid early in my life when my first spring here. I got in a pretty serious avalanche in some really wet spring conditions. Total stupid move that we had no idea what we were doing. And I got lucky, and that scared the hell out of me. So ever since then, which has been ever since I've lived here, minus 1 year, because that happened the first year, I've just been super, super cautious and just trying not to put myself in any compromising position. And even so, you're still going to wind up somewhere where you go, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah, because aspects can change. Even I was talking to a friend, it's like, oh, you know, we're in the backcountry, we dig a pit here. It's like, yeah, that's northeast facing. What happens when you swing around and it's changed, or the elevation drops, or the sun's hitting it? And
the wind came from all different directions last night, and now everything is different and everything is dangerous. And so that's what happened the second time I got slid, and that was a really bad one too. So all that's in the book.
Good. Yeah, I was gonna, do you talk about, and I'm sure part of being in the mountains so long with people, there has been trauma or tragedy. Is some of that in the book as well about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've lost so many people, and the book's dedicated to the people who we've lost. And there are some specific stories about death, mostly not, but there are some couple stories about firsthand experiences with death.
And I think it's important because when mountain athletes and people who've been in the industry really open up and talk about that, it's like, whoa, there's a lot of people have dealt with things and had friends die and trauma. And I think now we have a culture, we talk about it more, but I think for a while, I mean, it was like, okay, what do? You go and you numb yourself, you know, as opposed to like, okay, how do we move forward from this? And my risk tolerance right now after my ABI level 3, I just said, I want no part of going into terrain that can kill me. I love riding powder. I just want to have fun. This is my job. I don't need to put myself into harm's way. And like you said, every once in a while, shit does happen. You know, you end up in the wrong place and you thought it was good. And it's like, okay. But even with that, I've decided now I do not ski terrain that can kill me. Can an avalanche? Yes or no? Sure. But if it can avalanche and kill me at 44 years old, I just don't, it's not my wheelhouse anymore. And I've done enough stories about people that have died in avalanches, and I've had enough friends die in avalanches, and just heard about the trauma. And it just doesn't, a couple of years ago at SIA, I pissed off a lot of people. I had a sticker and it said, "My brain is smarter than your airbag." A lot of people got it. A lot of brands were really upset. And I said, look, you're promoting something that you're telling people that can just go out and get in avalanches. People die of trauma. I don't want my knee to hit my face. And this was the same when I went to Alaska up to Haines 20 years ago now. We had the avalanches. And I have a video of the guide saying, Mike, this slope's going to rip. You have two options. You either outrun it or you hold on tight. And I put the avalanche in, crack, crack, I start quacking. And I drop in, make two turns, the whole thing rips. They were thinking you're going to be able to breathe under the snow because you have this tool. And it's kind of, I don't get that. And it's a part of the sport where I'm like, really? This is, you're thinking, or like a beacon? I'm like, that's to find your body. So your mom and dad can have a funeral. I'm like, you know, the level three, we had to do three buried beacons in under 10 minutes. And I'm like, how bad have you fucked up? What kind of terrain choices and human factor? And so it's awesome that you had these mentors, because I do the same. I sponge anybody. Mm. I mean, Bruce Hayes is my backcountry ski partner. Mm. And like,
oh, nice.
He's on a different world, and just seeing, yeah, you know, his program. It's like, wow, you know, and less is more with him.
Yeah.
It's not about getting rad. It's just, let's go for a tour. Let's get some exercise. Let's get out in the mountains and just enjoy, you know, even the times I'm guiding with people, it's like, hey, you know, we might not go ski some big thing. It's about this right now, this whole experience being in the mountains. And so that's kind of what's kept me here. It's not, I mean, even now, I think it's the wildlife. I mean, I love skiing and snowboarding, but I seem to do it less and less as this business grows. I sit here and my team's out there, and it's okay. I still get my good days in.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned wildlife. It, of course, being in the mountains, that's ever since I moved here, that's all I wanted to do, is be outside all day long in the winter on skis, in the summer walking around or biking around or paddling around. And we have such these amazing lakes. I have some the funniest wildlife stories. You know, probably everybody's seen ermine running around, and I've been skiing down the slope, and I see ermine running across the top of the. They're so beautiful.
For our listeners that aren't familiar with Jackson, what can you describe an ermine?
An ermine is a lesser weasel. Technically, I think that's the official name of it, and it's a small weasel that turns white in the winter and is brown in the summer. And the only continuous color year-round is the black tip on his tail. And so they're just lovely creatures. They're really smart and agile, and they're vicious. One day on the trail crew, we saw this squirrel flopping around over in the snow. This is before the public was on the hill. And we went over, and the squirrel was decapitated, a bloody stump above the shoulders. And then I looked over, and there was an ermine with blood on his lips. And I was like, wow, those things are vicious. One time one came in our house, and my wife Holly and I jumped up on the bed because we were actually pretty afraid of those little rascals. So you'll see ermine and snowshoe hare and fox. But the wildest wildlife experience I ever had was, I was just coming off the top of Mount Glory, skiing down towards Twin Slides, and I made a couple of turns right off the top, and I skied right into this grouse. They are under the snow, and they have a little hole under there for the night. And so I skied right into him, and he came up into my lap. As I'm skiing down the mountain, he's flapping his wings against my lap, and he can't get away from me. And he flaps and flaps and flaps, and he's flapping up towards my head. And he finally gets right below my chin and pushes off and flies away.
Wow.
It was hilarious.
And there, I love grouse. I mean, they're a cute little, they kind of waddle around, and they've got the just beautiful colors and the feathers. And I mean, it's a fun animal to see.
They're pretty feisty, though. They'll attack you. They'll chase you. In the fall, if you go hiking and you see a grouse, you better watch out.
Or you better have a shotgun with you and a bird dog.
A slingshot. Yeah. Do the trick.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned the ermine. I live in an old cabin, and somehow some mice got in, and I set live traps, and I caught an ermine. And I'll show you the picture later. And Bruce was like, how on earth? And it was the cutest thing. And I mean, it had the little black tail, and it was all white, and it's looking at me. And I had heard they're real aggressive. And so like I actually took it up to Bruce's house, because I know he loves it. And I let it out in his driveway. And I had to like get a stick and open the trap, because I was like, oh, I mean, they look so cute.
I don't think they would attack us, but I've seen what they can do.
Yeah.
And I'm not really wanting to let them have a chance.
Okay, back to skiing. Over the years, who have been some of the people that you remember the most of shooting? Or if you've got some iconic photos, was it like going out with Doug, or were there other people that, you know, it was like that one day that I will always remember that? I'm sure there's a few that are, you know, ingrained into you.
You know, there are so many, there aren't just a few. It's just everything all the time, forever. All we ever did, we schemed on it. And we and you know, the different people cycled through. Yep. We had the office at the hostel in this, right at the base of the village, and you know, the skiers would just cycle through there.
Yep.
And over the decades, you know, that they were, you know, and some people were constant, you know, people that stayed longer for sure. Yep. Like Jason Tattersall, I mean, yep, he was there for, yep, five of the 5 decades.
Yep.
And Kevin Brazell, Jeff Ledger. You know, and of course, Pepe Steeler was always, he was on my hit list every winter. I would have a day with Pepe, and that was just part of the marketing, you know, plan.
Wow.
For the resort. You know, we need pictures, fresh pictures of Pepe every year. And for our magazine, you know, we wanted fresh pictures of Pepe every year, you know, and Doug as well. And then Tommy and Doug as well. And then Tommy Moe comes along in the 90s. Pepe, and then, oh gosh, the women, so many strong women skiers through the ages, you know, AJ Cargill, Lindsay Dyer, Jess McMillan. I can, you know, you just can name on and on and on and on.
But I mean, these are heavy hitters that you just listed. And I mean, people that are established, and you know, they didn't just show up. I mean, this was a long, all those people have put a long time in the mountains, and you know, it's wonderful that you acknowledge them, and I'm sure they acknowledged you in that same regard. They knew who they were going out with.
Well, and don't forget Julie Zell and all of the Zells.
Zells, you know, yeah.
Jimmy, Jeff, and Julie.
Oh, so good.
What a pleasure it was to shoot with all these people. And, you know, and the original Air Force guys, yeah. Benny Wilson, Howard Henderson, John Hunt, Rick Hunt, Adam McCool, Dave the Wave, Rick Armstrong, you know, and Rick and Jason, they were sort of like the second generation. And with them came John Scott and, oh, you know, you hate to start naming because you're going to forget somebody.
Totally. How'd you leave me off the list? Wait, I thought we skied. You lived with me.
Right. But no, I loved working with every single person. There are 228 different skiers in my book. And I knew the number was going to be big, and I hoped it was going to be over 100. I really had no idea. But one day, I just decided, well, I got to know. And this was just recently. I took the time. It took about an hour to go through it and count them all up and write them all down. And I was amazed. 228. That's great.
And those are just the people that made the book.
Well, yeah. And there's another probably 100. You know, so the book at one point was 800 pages. And this was when I was just putting photos together in decade arrangements and putting photos together that work well together. And I hadn't written much of anything, and I just couldn't stop. You know, I'd done this photo edit, I made all these scans. And so, oh, finally, I get to build a book. And I just kept doing it. And it's like, I think it was close to 900 pages at one point. And I was like, dude, you're sick. You have to stop. Yeah. You can't, this is not, yeah, this won't work.
Yeah. It's so good. Oh, man. Oh, I hope everybody goes out and buys the book and then get a group together and buy it in bulk, like you said. And then hopefully you live here. And if not, come out to Jackson and come, you know, when Wade puts on one of these events, you know, follow him on Insta. We'll share it anytime you're doing stuff because now we're connected. And so we're stoked. I mean, hopefully one day, I mean, I'd love to either go out and shoot with you or hire you to do something with us. I mean, it's so fun that now I've been able to tap in. Now that once we started hiring professional photographers, it took my website to a very different level. In the past, it had always been, you know, GoPro and, you know, our phones. There's a difference, and not only just having the photographer, but the eye. And, you know, we can go out and do one lap and get, you know, a whole board worth of photos in one lap. I'm like, how that was efficient, you know, and just leapfrogging. And so again, we can go to Kickstarter, and if they go to Kickstarter, they just type in your name. Is that kind of how that works?
They can, and they'll find it. And they can also type in the Arc of Skiing. And another thing, you know, if you're doing well on Kickstarter, the Kickstarter will select you as a project we love. And then you start showing up on their emails. And I think it was on day 4, I got the email from them saying, we've selected you as project we love. And I'm just like, hey, it's like, got up and was like,
because that's organic. Congratulations. Yeah. That's like, well, here you go.
Yeah. So
So that'll help. And, you know, the mailing costs are what they are. They're not horrible. And so, you know, if you don't live here, don't be afraid to pay for mailing. And yeah, buy a book. It's going to be cheaper now than it will be later.
Well, right on, Wade. I appreciate you coming on, and I look forward to going out with you sometime and really just reading the book. I mean, 500, you know, I've only been here for 15 years, and so I'm still like kind of learning about the history. And the more I dig into Jackson, I'm like, holy cow. Like, and it's interesting because so many of you that have been here a long time, I mean, there's a strong local community that has been here 40, 50, sick. I mean, the woman I was helping today, she's 86 years old and she's throwing bags of feed. And it's just, it's so wonderful to see that the outdoors and the skiing has kept so many people here and have made the sacrifices, you know, over the years, say, this is, I'm going to be here the rest of my life. Just, I don't care how that, what happens if I got to live here in the office, you name it. It's paradise. And I'm so blessed. You know, the TGR guys brought me out here, Steve and Todd, I appreciate that. And, you know, it's just great to meet you. And I've seen your photos for so many years. So this is killer. Everybody, episode 61. Again, Jackson Hole Mountain Resort sponsored this. They're a sponsor of the Mountain Weekly News this year. Wade, I appreciate everything. And you guys go out and buy that book. Follow them on Instagram. Super easy to find. And then, you know, if you're here in Jackson, you know, keep an eye out for them. You know, maybe you see them riffing around with this camera or skiing some cool stuff. So, Wade, I appreciate you coming on.
All right, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
It was fun.
Thank you.
All right.
It's great.
Right on.